Good morning and welcome to our panel on the very hot topic of central bank digital currency, or in short CBDC. I'm Siu Li and I'm from AusPayNet, the Australian Payments Network. We're a self-regulatory body in the payments industry. We'll be going through quite a lot of topics here, from just exciting projects around the world and what are the lessons we've learned here, as well as some of the misinformation. So we're joined here by a group of very esteemed women in their field, and I'll let them introduce themselves. We'll start off with Lisa.
Oh, hi, I'm Lisa Wade and I'm Head of Digital Innovation and Sustainability at National Australia Bank.
Thank you, Lisa. Michelle?
Yeah, hi, I'm Michelle Bullock. I'm the Assistant Governor of Financial System at the Reserve Bank, and I'm in charge of the area that's sort of looking at central bank digital currencies broadly.
And Nish?
Thanks, Silly. My name is Nish. I am Head of Product for GTS, which is Global Transaction Banking Services at Westpac. Great to be here.
Thank you. Good to have you all here. Nish, can you help us understand CBDC, what it is, what it's not, what is it different? How is it different from the other digital assets?
I thought the best way to start, that's a really good starting point, because there's a lot of acronyms going around in the industry, and people have different interpretations of it. So I'd go back to the academic definitions, and obviously Michelle and Lisa can then chime in later in when they're responding to some of the other related questions around this topic. So central bank digital currency is, put it very simply, it's an electronic form of value exchange. And you could almost say that it is ultimately controlled by the bank that issues and expected to be pretty much a high security digital asset. Now, in the central bank digital currency scenario, the market expects that to be centralized and regulated, making an ultimately risk-free asset for the market. Which is, when you think about cryptocurrency though, that is slightly different, because it's a digital currency where a transaction is verified and records are maintained, but not necessarily centralized like in the central bank digital currency. This cryptocurrency is decentralized in its form. For example, Bitcoin, where there is not a centralization issuing authority, and it is seen more as an asset class and then shared as a payment instrument. So if you take another example, stablecoin, you need to take another step further from cryptocurrency, because stable asset is very simply a cryptocurrency that is pegged to a stable commodity or a currency, and it is not expected to be volatile in terms of price movement. Maybe if I also just share one more definition, because everyone is interchangeably using blockchains and digital assets, as well as DLT, the distributed ledger technology. Very important to clear that blockchain or the digital distributed ledger technology is really a technology infrastructure that is provided and can be used to be able to operate within the cryptocurrency environment or through a central bank digital currency environment. So it's really a platform if you think of it that way. So that's kind of the high level, very strict academic definition, if I put it that way, Siri.
Thank you, Nish. There's so much public interest on CBDC. Michelle, it would be great if you could share with us the central bank's perspective on
that. Sure. What I might do is just start by asking why all of a sudden we're talking all about this all of a sudden. And I think there's a few big factors at play here. The first is that, and this isn't new, that there's a recognition that there's gaps in payment systems. And the two big gaps are financial inclusion in some countries, typically not in advanced countries, but in many developing countries, and cross-border payments, where there are lots of frictions, lots of costs, very, very costly, it's slow. So there's that. We've known about that for ages, and it's just percolating along the background. The second factor, I think, here is that there is a declining use of cash, as in banknotes, and that's been accelerated by COVID. And a lot of countries are saying, well, hang on, the central bank's main method of payment that it issues, the banknote, the claim on the central bank, is declining. Shouldn't central banks be offering an alternative claim on the central bank? So there's that in the background. And the third factor that's in the background here is just the increasing innovation and the whole digital money thing. Started with Bitcoin, but advancing. And I think something behind this is this really low interest rate environment we've been in since the global financial crisis. People are looking for ways to earn, basically, earn yield. So those three factors, I think, have generated, and there's been some specific events along the way, but they've generated just a lot of interest in this. And I'd have to say that in the last couple of years, the whole tempo among central banks has increased markedly in this. We have the Bank for International Settlements has been quite actively calling for central banks to be working on this. Many central banks around the world are. So let me just go back a little bit, and I'd like to expand on some things Nish said about definitions. When we talk about money in the economy, most of our money is actually already digital. Cash, which is the only non-digital thing, banknotes, it's only around 4% of the total sort of amount of deposits out there. Most money is already digital. It's just in commercial bank deposits. That's what it is. The other point I would make, and people I don't think of it this way, is that we actually already have a central bank digital currency. It's called exchange settlement accounts at the Reserve Bank. And that's the way that banks digitally move one another between one another. You know, ANZ doesn't take a big bag of cash and pay CBA with a big bag of cash. They exchange central bank account money, which is a digital currency. It's not the way people think about it in the context of a retail, what I would call a retail central bank digital currency. That's the concept that you, I, our mums and dads, our kids, all have some access to money which is a direct claim on the central bank, so like cash, like banknotes, except it's not in a physical form, it's in a digital form. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about central bank digital currencies in what I call a retail sense. So at the bank, we've been actually doing quite a lot of work on central bank digital currencies. Our focus initially, though, has been very much on what we call wholesale central bank digital currencies. So that's basically about settlement between financial institutions. It's money, it's big amounts of money exchanging hands. So like we do with exchange settlement accounts, but perhaps doing it with some sort of central bank digital token or something. And we've done a couple of experiments. One we tried to replicate a simple settlement model. So instead of doing it across central bank accounts, we experimented with issuing a central bank digital currency token, and then the banks themselves could exchange that token amongst themselves. And that was a very simple model. More recently, we've been doing some work with a couple of banks, CBA and NAB in particular, and a couple of other participants on a thing called Project Atom. And the concept there is that we have this wholesale digital currency, central bank claim on the central bank, and it's used to settle payments associated with a tokenized syndicated loan. So it's one step further along now. It's saying, can we use the central bank digital currency to affect delivery versus payment in some sense with another tokenized sort of asset? So that's really where our work has been focused. We have said in the past we don't really see a case for central bank digital currencies for retail use, although we're constantly looking at that issue, but other central banks have. And I'll just highlight a few and we can come back to some of these conversations. The Central Bank of the Bahamas, in fact, has one. It's called the Sand Dollar. And the motivation for them was a financial inclusion motivation. People didn't have bank accounts. China. The Chinese have developed, it's in pilot phase, a central bank digital currency. I think everyone's expecting it will go in to production, if you like. And their motivation is, I think, also financial inclusion, but also they're looking at the big techs, WeChat and Alipay, and worrying about the control of big techs over the payment system. Sweden and Europe are also looking at this issue. Sweden is very worried about the decline in cash and has a philosophical view that the central bank should be offering some sort of currency to their residents. And in Europe, I think it's motivated a lot by the fact that they want a single euro. So there's a few examples. The work is hotting up, as I said, and I think I'll just stop there and then we can pick up some of these themes later on. So thanks, Celia.
Thanks. I actually have a follow-up question for you, Michelle. You mentioned that there's so many different types of reasons why the public would look into CBDC. For Australia, what amongst the reasons are the most biggest motivator for Australia to adopt this?
I'd probably preface it by saying at the moment we don't see a lot of motivations because we have fast payment systems, we already have digital currency, we have a highly banked population, so there's not a financial inclusion issue. We have everything we really need. So the question is what gap would it fill? And for me, there's two potential gaps. One is the cross-border issue, which we can come to. The second issue is that in a world of digital, and if you don't have any cash, what happens if the systems go down? What happens if the electricity goes? What happens if you have a hurricane, a cyclone in northern Queensland and there's no power? How do people pay for things if there's no cash? There might be a role for something like this that can operate in an offline environment, which is a central bank digital currency. So there might be something there. So there's a couple of potential use cases, but if you looked across the board for me at the moment, I'm saying what gap does it fill for me?
Thank you, Michelle. Nish, there's so many interesting projects around the world. Can you talk to us about them from your experience?
Yeah, happy to. So I think let's just go back also to some of the points that Michelle was making. What are the motives of the countries to look into central bank digital currency? If I start with International Monetary Fund, IMF considers the main rationale for exploring central bank digital currencies really in advanced economies to be able to counter the growth of private forms of money. So if you think about it, and if you connect the dots there, this really is around, would you want to be able to have a controlled, a more regulated environment when it comes to private forms of money, which is particularly around the Bitcoin development. So it's like whether you put card before the horse or the other way around, it's more the Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies that are coming up, which probably led the markets to look at and say, what do we need to do, especially the regulators and the central banks. So coming back to the experience, I think Michelle spoke about China. We know experience in Singapore in particular, which with Project Ubin, which was a monetary authority of Singapore, which implemented all of the requirements. And they've already have a participation by two banks and an investor looking at wholesale settlement processes. That sits outside the central bank digital currency management framework, but it is nevertheless a wholesale solution, which I can talk about in a minute. Obviously, UK Bank of England came up with their omnibus account model, which is pretty much allowing the participants to be able to settle high-value payments, being able to fast-track the value exchange in the market. I think we also need to touch a little bit about what do we see as benefits. In order to understand the benefits and the use case, we need to look at, from a wholesale perspective, I'm in entire agreement with Michelle about the retail use case that is yet to be seen in the market. But if you look at a wholesale perspective, if you're a bank and we are settling wholesale transactions, specifically international money transfers, if you look at today's environment, we need to use multiple correspondent banks in order to take money from point A to point B. So if I'm settling from Australia to, for example, Thailand, I need to be able to have an account with a bank in Thailand, or Thailand bank needs to have an account with Westpac to be able to settle the money through the Australian dollar clearing system, and being able to then settle to a Thai baht account of a beneficiary. It has many stopovers, so you can even potentially think about 2 to 3 banks in the middle. Now, that sequencing order can be taken off with a more wholesale solution, followed through to value exchange in time, record keeping in time. It's almost instant settlement. And that can reduce some level of cost for the transaction as well. And these are yet to be tested in the market. And I feel that processing of such global scales really boils down to global interoperability of the central bank digital currencies. Reserve Bank here can say, here's my rules around the central bank digital currency. Reserve Bank in Thailand can have their own rules. So until we have that sort of uniformed approach to the way in which we are going to operate and rules around when someone does not operate within those framework is something really important. Because as a wholesale banker, to me, it's important that I have solutions to service the customer. And in certain transactions, international money transfers, value delivery, swap transactions, if you look at high value RTGS payments, if you look at FX transactions, all those are pretty good use cases, but it needs to start at some point.
Thank you, Nish. Lisa, can you help us understand a bit more about the technology side of things powering the CBDC, especially, you know, I think both Michelle and Nish touched on what are the true benefits of CBDC. Can you help us see it from the technology point of view?
Yeah, I think it's really important that there's a big distinction using the technology between digital money and programmable money, and perhaps we're using the wrong acronym because it's central bank programmable currency. So what sits inside the technology is an instrument called a smart contract, which programs the functionality of the financial instrument. And when you're facing off against another digital asset, say a syndicated loan, it's the conversation that can happen between the money and the financial instrument that's really important. And to create that conversation, we use what's called smart contracts, which are, and sorry, Michelle, I think we agreed not to call them smart contracts.
That's all right.
I can't believe I did that. Went straight there. And as Michelle points out, they're not that smart. Or development applications. So they're programs that are written on blockchain that operate the conversation between the money and the asset. And if you look at when we were talking about definitions before, we break it into four quadrants. So we have wholesale central bank digital currency, we have wholesale stablecoins, retail stablecoins, and retail central bank digital currencies. And for us at National Australia Bank, what we're, in terms of the gaps that Michelle was talking about, where we've been working is in this high value, low volume marketplaces such as syndicated loans, large renewable energy transactions. We have transactions inside the bank that can sometimes take months to settle because of the paper trail that is needed, the phone calls that need to get made to get all the buyers and the syndicates aligned. And we see a big use case there. So we've really been focusing on that area because the technology is quite slow, because the programming that sits inside of the development apps, or the dumb contracts we could call them, they take it quite a while to execute, much quicker than 3 months to settle on a syndicated loan. But we know that the payments part happens like right at the end. And the reason why Project ATOM is called Project ATOM, it's a shame the report hasn't come out yet, so we're still under NDA and can't reveal too much. But what the purpose of the project was to achieve what we call atomic settlement, which is the settlement of the asset and the cash at the same time. So we don't really compare a CBDC to an NPP payment rail. What we're comparing it to is how we did things before with the financial instrument to what we can do now with the functionality that the technology is allowing.
Can I just jump in there? I think your point about programmable money and digital asset is a very important one, because what you've just explained there for me is why it is in the wholesale space that this is of most, at the moment, I think of most importance. This concept of being able to have atomistic settlement, of being able to program the way that things will happen, I think is very important in those markets. I'm not as convinced it's so important in the retail space in terms of me paying you or me paying the merchant or something like that. The other point I just wanted to make, and you alluded to it, and that's the issue of settlement. It's very important that in the high value space, one of the things that we get out of our current digital system, there's not programmable, but it's digital money, is that when it's settled, it's final and it's done. And so whatever the technology provides in this sense, it's really important that this concept of probabilistic settlement doesn't exist in high value. We can't have a circumstance where there's a really high value settlement and it's not quite certain for a while. That's a step backwards. That's why all those things you're talking about are I think crucial to this particular aspect.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the technology sense, like if I went super geeky down into the layers of what you're talking about, there are different types of algorithms that you could use to create that finality. And that is where the distinction really comes from, because in the wholesale use cases, we have to have finality. Those development apps are much more complex pieces of code, and so they're much slower than the NPP. Mm. And then when you get into the retail world, the retail stablecoins don't have the finality. There is, and I'm an investment person, not a banker, actually, and I see the risk in a different way, right? because it's so small for a bank that it's almost tolerable. However, there is a single point of failure where somebody could deny that the transaction existed, and then the bank would have to take the risk on that because of the way that the algorithms are written. And we're really not there yet in terms of the technology for the retail finality. Now, we're working very hard. We're working with great technology companies. There's some fantastic emerging technologies that all of the banks in Australia are coming together to look at and work on together. And I think that's one thing that's really important is that, and I think Nish alluded to it, it's sort of my favourite African quote, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. Mm. And it's something that we need to be in conversation with and work towards. And it's one of the interesting things, and I don't want to get myself in trouble, but I'm good at that apparently, is when we started Project Atom, I was quite indifferent to the central bank digital currency piece. I'm not a payments person. I've learned a lot, and very humbling to learn about the payment system and the great one that we have in Australia. I was really interested in the syndicated loan. And then I had this moment where I realised that my little syndicated loan project was not going to work unless I had the central bank digital currency. And that's where Project Atom came from, bringing the work together and working with the RBA, because I really saw that we need the central bank digital currency as what we call an on-ramp into this world that we're creating, which we're calling Web 3.0. So Web 1.0 was when we just used to do chat and email on the internet. Then we move and, you know, look up a website, get some information. Then we move to Web 2.0, which is where payments happen with a credit card, and there's a rail that sits above. Web 3.0 is where the asset transaction, whether it's buying a pair of sneakers or a house or a building, sits in the Web 3.0 ecosystem, and all the payments happen atomically where the assets and the cash settle at the same time, which de-risks a lot of things. Mm. So when I started thinking about retail, I sort of had that moment again where I looked into the future and I thought, well, what if my parents were shopping online? I don't want them to have a dodgy stablecoin that's backed to a terrible treasury that my dad thinks is the Australian dollar, that they wake up in the morning and that's what's sitting in his wallet. I really want us to have these credible stablecoins. And then I think there's a question about whether, as Michelle said, we already have this great ESA system in Australia, and then maybe it's the responsibility of the retail banks to be providing what we call the on-ramps for the mums and dads, and providing that secure system in the way that we do with people's bank accounts, and the responsibility falls on us. So perhaps, and this is only just occurring to me in the last couple of weeks, the reason why the Reserve Bank may never see a use case for them to do it is because maybe what we have with the ESA is so good that then the banks can take the reins and have this security where the mums and dads and my parents can have, you know, they'll have their National Australia Bank bank account, and then they'll have their National Australia Bank CBDC account, where we've done the fractionalisation and done the work on the algorithms and all the things that need to happen to speed it up. And I think what probably will happen is we'll probably start with a hybrid, which is sort of a semi-wholesale central bank digital currency, and people may be able to settle their houses or, you know, large value cars or large, you know, high value, low volume is sort of our mantra inside of CNIB, and we might be able to bring that across and then transition. And there'll be lots of stablecoin companies that would disagree, and I'm sure I disagree with myself on many levels, but that's sort of a way to look at it from the point of view of what we already have.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, can I just add a little bit of perspective there, Lisa? I also agree with you that the retail use case is somewhat, you know, to be experienced. It's just not there yet, but it will get there at some point in the future. But I want to go back to the learnings from the history. So if you go back to 2008, the global financial crisis, which most of us are old enough to remember, the Lehman Brothers, so much to remember. The Lehman Brothers failure, for example, was actually a time difference between the time that Lehman Brothers settlements took place between Europe and the US, and which was the starting point, although that's not the root cause for the entire global financial crisis. And I rethink about it and replay that thinking, if you have had an completely interoperable central bank digital currency that could have supported such wholesale, large, extremely significant settlements within seconds, we would have still probably seen a financial crisis, but nevertheless, it would have been something less prone to the time lapse, or probably to the time that the settlements typically take today. So it's really interesting when you think about it in that way, because there are benefits of central bank digital currency, clearly, the avoidance of the systemic risk, making sure that we have removed that whole sequential methods of settlements that we are experiencing today, obviously fast and value exchange within that very fast timelines, and then the massive amount of focus on record keeping and the security of the data. So it's really, you know, giving you that secure data and clearing and settlement option. You could probably almost think in another 5 years, if we have had a GFC scenario, you would have identified much faster and quicker. You may not even have had it because you trust all the settlements within one single framework.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a path we probably shouldn't go too far down. But one of the big sort of disconnects, I think, with the use cases around that using the blockchain technology in general is this transparency piece. And in fact, obviously, the GFC was created by investment markets, and the greatest disruption or revolution happens at the investment level, because it opens up portfolio managers to be able to invest in different types of assets in different ways, because the transparency is better and you can create liquidity in traditionally illiquid assets, which will open things up a lot. And I think that's a big piece of work that will get unpacked as this market evolves and we institutionalize the technology, for want of a better term.
Lisa, can I also ask you about the infrastructure? Are we there yet in terms of infrastructure for the explosion of use of CBDC?
Oh, absolutely not. There is so much that needs to be built. You know, a lot of us have been greatly and a little bit frustratingly doing proof of concepts and pilots. And then there is a very big difference between a pilot and a production grade system. And that's the leap that everybody needs to take. And everybody's sort of taking it in a different rhythm and in a different way. But we do need to take a big leap to get into that production grade. And there's a lot of building that needs to be done. And then, you know, there's a lot of controversy around the sustainability and the power usage and things like that. And I do think we need to solve for that. And we need to be looking at, you know, really looking at not repeating the same mistakes of the past, which is growth being linked to carbon emissions, and actually look for ways that we can have this growth and decouple ourselves from pollution and emissions as we develop. And I think we have like the greatest opportunity of all time to actually build this infrastructure in, let's go beyond sustainable finance, let's talk about regenerative finance, and really build this technology for good, to do good. And you know, I'm very hopeful that we will do that, because it's like an intersection of evolutions, right? You've got the evolution of sustainable finance, and that, you know, where in my world, sustainable finance is mainstream. And then you've got the evolution of this technology. And if we can sit somewhere in the middle with how we build all this infrastructure, then I think we can actually make great change. And, you know, we're all talking about net zero. We could be optimistic and just blow that out of the water.
I see Michelle nodding there, and I think there's few things we can talk to that. One is, do we see other countries also looking at that from that angle, how they're going to do it sustainably? The other is what is also, the central points, central bank's view. Is it, would you both like to talk to it?
Let me just say a couple of things on, I mean, central banks are clearly focusing on sustainability from a couple of perspectives. There's the financial stability perspective and the impact on the financial system and so on. So that's one perspective. They're also looking at their own operations, I think, as other corporations and firms are. One area that has had some recent focus in some countries has been the carbon footprint of the note printing business, the bank note printing business. And it has a reasonable carbon footprint because you're moving lumps of cash around the country, you're transporting them around the country and so on. So conceivably, at least, there is the digital economy offers a lower, conceivably, a lower footprint. So I think there is work to be done there. I agree with Lisa that it is an opportunity. One of the big things that people talk about with Bitcoin and some of the crypto assets, I'm not calling them cryptocurrencies, crypto assets, is their big energy footprint. And it's not only that they are energy using coal, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're using renewables, but they still have a massive energy consumption. So the more they're consuming, the less others can consume. It's their, so this whole energy consumption issue, I think, is a very big issue. And we've got to get, to Lisa's points, I'm no expert in this area, but I think this is going to be something that will be in the thinking of central banks as they think about how this might be implemented, if it will be.
Oh, absolutely. I've nicknamed it the Polygon Pivot because we are doing most of our deployment work into the Polygon network or the Hedera network at the moment because they're more eco-friendly and it's a big concern. I mean, I can easily argue the point that it's only 0.5% of world energy consumption and US households consume 15%. Yep. And that would sort of probably shoot myself in the foot because, there is this opportunity to support networks that use less energy. And, Bitcoin was incredible. We are learning so much. It's probably going to be one of the biggest game changers in history. However, probably it's a victim of its own success in terms of energy consumption. And now we can learn and pivot into leveraging this technology and building better so we can actually have good money.
Yeah.
And I think from a bank, if I take a banker's view, talking of systems, banks are always grappled with the legacy infrastructure that we've built around. So if we are thinking about the state-of-the-art technology stack coming through, whether it's Bitcoin or central bank digital currency, what this means for banks is really they need to uplift their infrastructure, which will obviously require some level of capital expenses. So it's something that the banks will need to start thinking about. And that sort of ties in to an extent with some of the other industry initiatives of us going into more standardized payment messages through ISO, as well as open banking. So I feel there's going to be some kind of a natural endpoint or a natural next extension towards this initiative, but we still need a few more foundational work to be done. We need to get ISO done. We need to be very clear on where we are heading with open banking. We need to be clear on what problem statement on the wholesale front we are trying to resolve for. And sometimes it almost feels like they're looking for the problem, so we just have to be really clear. And without absolute guidelines, more universal around the framework, acceptance, operability, interoperability, as well as rules and consequence management, if any of the markets don't abide by the rules, I think that we need to consider going in with eyes wide open to this.
I have to say, though, despite all that, I get plenty of emails from companies telling me they can set me up a central bank digital currency in a week.
Oh my God.
Very aspirational.
Send them my number, please.
So far, where we've gotten to is we need a clear problem statement. We need to understand what benefit it truly brings above the current forms of payment. We also talked about the need for further investment into infrastructure for it to be stood up, for CBDC to be more gaining popularity. Let's turn to the regulatory gaps. And from what we've discussed as well, it seems like it, you know, we see that it's probably going to be more deployed for use for the in the wholesale in the wholesale environment compared to regulator retail side of things. Are there also a greater regulatory gap in the retail use of CBDC versus the wholesale CBDC?
I mean, I don't mind going first on that one. I thought it was interesting that retail CBDCs were mentioned in the Bragg report, which is sort of the closest indication we have of regulations coming down the pipe. Mm-hmm. I don't think Australia is alone in being at the nascent stage of trying to understand how to regulate this. And being an investment person and now a banker, you know, we always hold ourselves to the highest standards. So I don't innovate any product unless I assume that it's going to be regulated to the highest standard of the digital twin that I'm creating. And I'm operating from the assumption that we need the regulation. We need solid, good financial infrastructure. We need regulation so that we can have sound financial systems.
Yeah. Can I come at it from two different angles? The first angle is central bank digital currencies in and of themselves wouldn't typically need to be regulated because they're being issued by a central bank. Central bank has no credit risk, so it's sort of different. The concept of the regulatory framework for the non-central bank digital currencies, in particular stable coins and possibly crypto, which Bragg talked about, it's a very difficult space. Everyone is grappling with it, and I won't go into it. But coming back to the central bank digital currencies thing again, there is a discussion about banknotes, of course, are anonymous in the sense that you can exchange them and no one needs to know that you've exchanged them. Would central bank digital currencies offer a similar experience? So could I pay Lisa with complete anonymity? No one can track that I paid Lisa. I have to say that I think that's reasonably unlikely in the case of if you are moving into a retail central bank digital currency. Wholesale, obviously, must be able to do this. But the concept of a retail central bank digital currency that allowed people to just not be tracked in terms of what they were paying, to be completely anonymous, I think is highly unlikely. I don't think central banks would go down that route. There might be there would be rules around privacy. There might be rules around when you were allowed to actually track where people were sending their money. But basically, you wouldn't have a purely anonymous style of central bank currency, in my view. I think that's an extremely unlikely outcome.
And I agree with you, Michelle. I think if you take a look at all of the good amount of uplifting done on the anti-money laundering and other regimes, it's clearly something that banks ourselves would be very clear on how do we go about identifying the depositor. I don't think we haven't even got to the stage of whether the retail use case is going to talk about digital deposits. I'd like to think it as different. It's more about can you have a digital currency of exchange, so it's more for payments as opposed to really can I have a digital deposit account. That's I don't think we've got there yet. If we do, then we obviously need to consider data privacy. We need to consider consumer protection and rights, access to information, as well as anti-money laundering and other legislation that's going to come through. And the other thing is really important when you think about the retail cases, would the individual, a consumer, can understand the concept? Because it's almost like, is it really a financial product that you think that someone, an average person, can understand? That's going to be the challenge for the bank, to how to make it well understood and make sure that target market determination is well established and the customer understands, I'm buying into something that I truly know what the consequences are for.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's almost moving from a world of deposits and interest to holdings and staking.
And absolutely.
Yeah, a different language.
Yeah. Final thoughts, one prediction, one final thought on CBDC. I'll start with you again, Lisa.
Okay. The problem I'm solving for is that Web 3.0 is here, and that pretty much means our house is on fire. And so my prediction is that we will have a Web 3.0 world with good infrastructure built, with eco-friendly chains, and we'll enter that world by 2030.
And Michelle?
Well, my prediction actually is that notwithstanding all I said about the use cases for retail CBDC, my prediction is actually that's exactly where we're heading. I think enough countries will start going down this route and we're going to end up there. That's my bold prediction.
Oh, and what she said too.
And actually, I'm going to extend that a little bit. I think your colleague, Head of Payments Policy, Mr. Tony Richards, spoke a little bit about that prediction.
Yes, he did.
Would you like to expand on that a little bit, on what he said?
Oh, sure. Well, he gave a speech the other day, which I think set the cat amongst the pigeons. The summary I would give was that he basically felt that stablecoins and central bank digital currencies for retail use actually get up and running. That cryptocurrencies, as so-called, or crypto assets, really, I think he used the word fad, that they will be niche use, they won't be mainstream use. So it's not, it's central bank digital currencies for retail use will basically ensure that they're not a payment. I don't think they are at the moment anyway, but will ensure they won't be used for payments.
And niche.
Yeah, so I think I'm on two extremes. On one side, the wholesale problem that we would really like is a good settlement system for high-value payments. It's not the mainstream product, something that we can do cross-border. So if you can look at that, that's really a sort of a wish in our wish list. Then on the other side, I also feel we should watch China, because China can be a big influencer of how the retail space would work in. I mean, a couple of years ago when we started thinking about Alipay or Alibaba, I don't think people expected this much of influence to the global e-commerce to the extent that we are seeing now. So if China is coming out with the e-currency and that's going to expand, I have a strong feeling that the world will be watching and following through, because they have that strong conviction that that is a currency for the globe once they start doing that. It'll be interesting to watch China, really.
It would be, isn't it, because China also invests massively into infrastructure.
Correct.
And it's also interesting, quick question on that. Do you think China is also spending a lot, doing well in creating awareness amongst its public, especially to some of the traditionally financially excluded people?
Oh, I'll answer that really quickly because it's one of my passions. But look at One Belt, One Road. They're going into Africa. That is the heart of the unbanked. It's where all of this work that we've all been doing started with M-Pesa. So absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you very much for our session today. I think we've covered a lot of grounds, from trying to understand what CBDC really does and what value it creates for us, and also the regulatory gap. So we're spot on at 10 o'clock. We'll leave you to
join
that session. Okay.